Okay.
I've just got so many different kind of versions of what I want to say. I have to figure out which I'm going to use. I'll probably skip around. We ended last time having introduced the structure of the relationship between faith and pure insight. Pure insight representing the Enlightenment project. And I said that they shared, both faith and pure insight, shared fundamental premises, namely that they both believe that the authoritative grounds for believing any claim has to be subject to the claims of subjectivity, that truth or universality is immediately accessible to subjectivity and particularity, and that secondly, to be in possession of any claim on these authenticating grounds is to be in possession of grounds of belief that are universal. So they both want, as it were, in a different, in very different ways, to think the I think. That is that moment of utter subjectivity and utter universality. I went on to suggest, and I want to spin this out a little bit now, that this section of the phenomenology provides the structural underpinnings for Adorno and Horkheimer's dialectic of enlightenment. And we can see this by just looking at the structure of the chapter in part. The chapter is divided into two parts. The first part involves the argument that Enlightenment thought construes all religious belief, here faith, as nothing but anthropomorphic illusion. That is, I mean, this is just the classical problem of the critique of religion, right? That religion is nothing but the projection of the human onto nature. And that's all religion has ever been, is the projection of the human onto the natural world. The job of enlightenment critique, is to provide a permanent critique of all illusion. And that enlightenment is going to argue that something is an illusion if it is a projection of human meaning onto the natural world, onto material nature. Now, if we think about this claim for just a moment, it actually is a bit of a scorched earth policy. Because, the question is, what counts as a projection of the human onto the material world? And the argument can be, and indeed by Enlightenment rationality has been, that any claim that is relative to the human standpoint, that is, relative to an individual seeing the world from a definite perspective, can count as an anthropomorphic illusion. Hence, the idea that of anthropomorphic illusion has an immensely wide and skeptical scope.
Clearly, things having colors is relative to our sensory apparatus.
Our capacity to think of other human beings as speaking meaningfully is relevant to our responding to them in certain ways. Hence, from a certain standpoint, simply to regard another human being as human is an anthropomorphic illusion, since it's a relational and relative claim. Now, this is exactly the difficulty that Horkheimer and Adorno detect in the notion of Enlightenment critique, that it has no intelligible stopping place, no place it can say this, except the I think itself. That is, the only thing left, if you keep going through the process of critique, would be the critic, him or herself. So the very notion of enlightenment critique is the principle of a radical negativity. It is, enlightenment is, if I'm right, a form of skepticism. Which is why we don't have more time to say that the critique of myth becomes itself a return to myth. We are going to see that this restless negativity, this skepticism, this idea of tolerating nothing that does not stand up to the criteria of self-evidence, right, is going to run right through from Enlightenment to the French Terror. In fact, it's going to be the same movement. The French Terror, you might say, is Enlightenment rationality in practice. That's certainly Hegel's claim. The second part of the chapter, Pure Insight, then asks, well, what kind of content can enlightenment rationality have? What is enlightenment other than critique? And as I suggested at the end last week, the substance of critique, the sense that critique is valuable, the sense that critique is meaningful, turns on its capacity to dissolve illusions. And illusions are going to again be anything that's relational. So it's going to have this sense that it's continuously making progress, but that power, that sense of power, is itself, if this is right, wholly skeptical. So that philosophy, in this mode, gets a grip on us because of its skeptical power. Enlightenment can be, therefore, at the end of the day, nothing but the self thinking itself. It reduces to the principle of apperceptive self-awareness, the I think. Hence, enlightened reason, without its critical object, without anything to critique, is literally subject without substance. Enlightenment needs faith. It receives all its capacity to look like it's accomplishing something from its critical object. course, I mention this here because
one way in which Hegel presents the entire phenomenology at the beginning of the book in the preface, which eventually we'll get to maybe, is subject becoming substance and substance becoming subject. Well,
to say that we are at this moment of subject without substance, right, is a kind of realization of the problem, right, that in part inaugurated Hegel's project. So for Hegel, and I would argue for Adorno, the epitome of the Enlightenment subject is just the empty self thinking itself, which is to say, again, that Enlightenment borrows its worth from it, the object it repudiates. It borrows its worth from the object it repudiates, and that should, you should hear in that, right, something like the relationship between master and slave, right? The master receiving all his recognition from the being that, right? I mean, so now we've got this in a deep epistemic structure, which we call the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment only has any worth in relationship to the very thing it devalues, namely appearances. And it takes all appearances to be, or discovers all appearances to be illusory, right? So it can't make any worthwhile distinction between appearance and illusion. Hence, it cannot have any productive notion of shine. So this is what Adorno and Horkheimer mean by the thought that Enlightenment is the critique of myth, that is, of anthropomorphism, that ends up turning on itself. And the reason we can say that it's turning on itself is because it is indeed getting, since it's getting all its content from the object it criticizes, then it is non-detachable, right? It's absolutely dependent on its critical object. So in paragraph 324, Hegel says, suffering, sure. Ah, it's one of those nice long paragraphs. Four lines. Thank God. In the first place, in regard to the relation of the inner to this, whoops, this can't be right. I'm sorry. Paragraph. No, it must be it's paragraph 541, I reckon. It's the end of paragraph 529, or toward the end. It's an endless paragraph. It's over the page, page 224, where he says, pure insight at the top of the page has therefore, in the first instance, no content of its own, because it is negative being for self. To faith, on the other hand, there belongs a content, but without insight. Okay, so we've got now the old hobby horse, right? That insight is empty, and that faith is blind. So we now know that
insight is just another word for the concept, and faith another word for intuition. But of course, he's not going to argue, this is not Kant, he's not going to argue that concepts without intuitions are empty and intuitions without concepts are blind. He's rather going to argue that, I'll use a word that I haven't used before for the first time, that this is a speculative sentence. And we'll have to figure out what speculation is. But the speculative sentence is, faith and pure insight are one. That is, they are two halves of an integral freedom that do not add up. And that last phrase is not from Hegel, but from Walter Benjamin. Two halves of, but he's talking there about high art and the art of the culture industry, but Benjamin wrote speculative sentences. Two halves of an integral, they mutually depend on one another, but their very construction is a construction in mutual repudiation of one another, so that they belong together, but we experience in them a fundamental diremption. And in the diremption from one another, we, of course, are diremed, split off, alienated from ourselves. So having no content of its own, pure insight is a drive to intellection and rationality, a metaphysical desire for universality, and as such, it challenges every content to meet its standard of rationality, namely some notion of something like self-evidence or certainty. And in paragraph 541, Hegel argues that pure insight gives itself its content, as I've been suggesting, now he says it concretely, through its skeptical procedures, which is to say, by the critique of religion. Faith is here cited as a consistent realm of error. The masses are naive and credulous before the priesthood. They suffer from the despotism of the church, etc. Because faith itself is skeptical, that is, because faith, part of the problem at the moment of the Enlightenment is that, and this, by the way, is the whole history of religion, according to Weber. Faith always wants to argue with reason. Big mistake. Because once it argues with reason, it throws itself into doubt. That is, it takes on the standpoint of the enemy, and therefore can't hold itself in place, so that so that while enlightenment disavows its own identity with the faith it castigates, it thereby preserves that content, but now as something unabsorbable. That is, it won't allow it to have any conceivable meaning. In her analysis, leading on to the French Revolution,
Tomei presents this thought as arguing that there is a constitutive melancholia afflicting insight. And its melancholia is what condemns it to its own violence. That is, the violence it...
And this is, again, just a movement that I like to... By its negative attack on faith, it ends up excoriating itself as an impossible emptiness, and therefore the violence it perpetrates on faith, saying it's all empty and worthless, is matched only by, from his word, is insight's manic jubilation. That is, there's something hysterical about enlightenment rationality. There's something about an incessant pleasure in the cruelty of its practice, a certain constitutive living off of the power of its violence, right? And it does not see that very manic pleasure in destruction is simply its inability to acknowledge that other as its own. Let me think about this in another way and see puzzle works. Everything at this point in the text is going to depend on broken relationships in which the thought of absolute dependence, of one's dependence on the other, this is going to be true epistemically, as well as morally and politically, every thought of dependence is met with violent denial. That is one of the things that we find most intolerable, most unacceptable, is that we are absolutely dependent on one another. And therefore, the only thing we can do in order to escape this sense of dependence is to destroy the very other we are dependent on.
Let me put that argument another way. Paragraph 549. Hegel says, whomsoever I trust, his certainty of himself is for me the certainty of myself. I recognize in him my own being for self, know that he acknowledges it, and that it is for him purpose and essence. Trust, however, is faith. Trust, however, is faith. Because the consciousness of the believer is directly related to the object and is thus also intuitively aware that it is one with it and in it. I want to think about faith and pure insight for a moment as what I want to call fundamental or constitutive anthropological moods. Faith, I'm going to suggest, is the mood of trust, and insight is the mood of suspicion, doubt. Why? And what's the dialectic between them? Faith is here presented as being in possession of an unconditional ground for trust. That's one way of expressing what faith means. And by the way, I think that's what Barth,
right? I think that's his idea of our relationship to God. And this is just late modern Protestant theology. Your relationship to God is your absolute dependence on the other.
That's just what Barth's theology is, I think. So, faith is this belief in being in possession of this ground. So, it, in a certain blinded way, the notion of faith is a transcription of the attitude of trust in the other. Mutual trust is an image or form of mutual recognition. Faith, that's what Hegel's arguing. Faith thus expresses an absolute trust in the other, which is a recognition of my absolute dependence on the other, which, if deserved, if appropriate, gives me back my being for self, my independent self. So what faith is a rationalized and ruined version of trust. That is, faith is trust in the world after trust in the world has disappeared. Right? Faith is always all faith is a disbelief in the existence of God, right? And that's just obvious. Right? You can only have faith because there is no God and he does not exist. Otherwise, faith would be unnecessary. So the experience of faith is the experience of the loss of the possibility of trust in the world. Someday, I've been invited to give a paper at the English Institute next year at Princeton on bad faith. That is, the thought of all faith is rotten and bad. And I just couldn't resist that possibility of trying to argue that. But I think it's true. Okay. Faith, thus, is... faith is what happens to trust when it is torn from the world of intersubjective relations and forced into the recesses of subjectivity. Faith is the desperate attempt to acknowledge dependency when the conditions of acknowledgement have been eviscerated. As I've already suggested, both faith and enlightenment, faith and pure insight, are nothing but the self thinking itself. Their dialectic occurs because, again, there's a mutual repudiation of one another. So the question now is, why does faith, as ruined trust, and that's my thesis, it's a ruined form of recognition, end up as nothing but an empty self-relation? And the answer is, as blind, as absolute, it has no relationship to its object. That is, faith is the impossible yearning for the object in the absence of the object. So the only thing that binds me to the objective world is the self-confidence that I've got it. So there's an ambivalence. This is what, by the way, the whole chapter turns, or the section of it, turns on an ambivalence. Hegel keeps saying that these are the same. Well, why? Well, when insight says to faith, look, you know, you think you believe in God, it's just merely subjective. Faith says, that's what I keep telling you. Right? I keep telling you I'm in immediate possession of the absolute. Right? So the two positions can't separate themselves out.
They both think that subjectivity and the absolute are one, but in these utterly differentiated modes. Pure insight now, so I want to think about faith as an exemplar of what I'm calling this anthropological mood of trust. Pure insight is a permanent critique, is grounded in a mood of suspicion. And you will see when we get to the French Revolution, Hegel's going to argue that the epistemology of the terror is suspicion. Are you really one of us? How do I know that you're really a revolutionary? Prove it. Since the proof cannot be had, the guillotine, right? And just going to work just like that, over and over. Okay, so there's this mood of suspicion. Now, this is an anthropological mood, I'm arguing, because it is a general orientation that allows more specific philosophical positions to emerge. It sees in trust, and this is the point I wanted to get to, only the threat of self-loss. That is, in the experience of absolute dependence, I don't get myself, I lose myself. And therefore, so the mood of suspicion is a defense mechanism against the possibility of collapse into the other. The mood is one of never seeing myself in the other, seeing myself always as possessing a perfect independence from the other. Right? Suspicion is the demand for absolute independence, which is unsatisfiable, and which is why it is ends up as a kind of manic skepticism. You have to keep doing it over and over and over again, because nothing is going to convince you you are really independent if, you know, and it can drive you nuts when you're teaching undergraduates, you know, because you say, oh, well, look, at least let's accept, you know, the law of non-contradiction. And some undergraduate will say, oh, yeah, well, that's a power over me. No, I'm going to rebel against that, you know, and you realize that anything that has a claim to independence or objectivity then looks like a power over you, is coercion, is a denial of you. That's what suspicion is. And it is irreducible, I'm arguing. Irreducible. As a mood. As, I'm using the Heideggerian, obviously I'm trying to use a kind of Heideggerian kind of notion of mood. Now, if put this way, then the relationship of trust to suspicion you can now think of as one version or as the mood that gets worked out and fails in the master-slave dialectic, right? In the actual dialectic of independence and dependence, the one thing that never happens, that looks impossible, is trust. The master enters into the battle for pure recognition in order to demonstrate independence from nature. He does not need to trust it or others because eventually he makes himself transcendentally independent of nature. And we know what the master does not see is that he is absolutely dependent on the slave twice over. The slave knows that he is dependent on the master, but that fact is intolerable to him. And he seeks to transform himself through transforming nature in order to make himself independent. Remember, Stoicism, skepticism, all those moods of self-consciousness are right? Illusory forms of independence.
For both master and slave, dependency is seen as negative, something to be overcome. Faith and pure insight cannot provide convincing accounts for the preference of one of them over the other, because in both cases they have deprived the self of all transcendence, all actual dependency, and hence they both end up as a kind of self-certainty. Faith, of course, finds the arguments that, kinds of criticisms that pure insight makes, beside the point. And you might say they're beside the point because I almost want to be Wittgensteinian here. The thought of faith is something that is such a deep-seated and constitutive orientation toward the world as a whole cannot be a matter of delusion. That it may be wrong in how it thinks about itself, right? But it must have something right if it has the capacity to provide for significant, reproducible social relations. The notion of religion, as I've said in Hegel, is the notion of cult, always, and therefore always the notion of religious practice. It's now that this religious practice is being forced to have a reflective understanding of itself as grounded in faith, and therefore the reflective self-understanding of its practice, right, is undermining of itself and the practice. Nonetheless, in paragraphs 552 through roughly 558, Hegel tries to show that at each point the Enlightenment critique misfires. So it misfires because, as I've already said, faith wants to say, yeah, subjectivity and absolute are one. When Enlightenment says, oh, well, what's this stuff about relying on Scripture? Enlightenment forgets its own mediations. When Enlightenment says those things in the church, they're just bits of wood, Enlightenment is coerced into a reductive material. Right, so, each time it tries to show the emptiness of religion, it ends up emptying itself out of making itself worldless. when religion sanctifies its form of religiosity, pure insight comes up with its own form of religion, namely deism. The idea of the clockmaker God. And it's introduced in paragraph 560. When we think of deism, we should not be thinking merely of the argument from design, but rather, Hegel argues, as a far more generous way of seeing how the universe fits together as a whole. Namely, it is a picture of the world, a picture of the universe, in which each thing is both for itself, just this thing, and purposeful for the other. That is, each thing is both in itself and for another. Everything in the universe, for deism, is useful, purposeful. And of course, Hegel's arguing that this that is the source, the ultimate, the real source of utilitarianism, not the nasty version of it that comes from thinking about capital, but thinking about an idea of everything as metaphysically purposeful. So this idea is that comes from a very modern way of thinking about the world, naming the world as made. We may say that the difference between Enlightenment religion and traditional religion, in traditional religion, the world is created. Omnes creatum. In Enlightenment religion, it's made. The way, indeed, a clock is made. So, it is made as an artifact. So everything fits together in terms of having a purpose or use. And Hegel then, I think, provides actually a very compelling account of this, let's call it utilitarian metaphysics. But he says that this utilitarian metaphysics and the materialism that it goes along with both share fundamentally in a representational theory of knowledge which ends up as itself subject to skeptical doubt. But he equally suggests that there's a way around this. Why not, he asks, and this is how he understands what happened, why not apply the theory of utility to beliefs as well as actions? Kind of anticipation of pragmatism, right? That is, we will hold just those beliefs that work and work well, blah, blah, blah. So this would allow for a theory of knowledge and action that is imminent and self-correcting. In short, utilitarianism does not need deism. Well, on the way to this argument, in paragraph, so I've kind of leapt from deism to utility. And in the middle, toward the end of section A, is paragraph 573. this form,
paragraph 573, forms the needful background for understanding what Hegel is going to think about utility.
So after he has done his dialectical work, Hegel says that for faith, the absolute is unknown and unknowable, and then goes on to say that the difference between faith and enlightenment is that enlightenment is satisfied and faith is unsatisfied enlightenment. It's a yearning for the absolute. And he carries on. However, we shall see whether enlightenment can remain satisfied. That yearning of the troubled spirit, which mourns over the loss of its spiritual world, lurks in the background. Enlightenment itself bears within it this blemish of unsatisfied yearning. As pure object in its empty absolute being, as action and movement in its going beyond its individual self to an empty and unfulfilled beyond, and as an object with a content in the lack of selfhood in the thing that is useful. Enlightenment will rid itself of this blemish. A closer examination of the positive result, which is in truth, will show that in the result the blemish is in principle already removed. What Hegel is arguing here is that the emptiness of faith entails the emptiness of enlightenment. That enlightenment in emptying out faith empties out itself. Hence, everything that follows, and that's why this paragraph is so important, and these claims about mourning and yearning for what? For the lost object. Everything from here on in is going to be about the lost object. And it's almost impossible, when we read this, not to think of the lost object in purely psychoanalytic terms. That is, this is about the originary constitutive loss of the object. Right? That object that we never had, right? And that we yearned for, that would make everything all right. So let's say that, I can see the puzzled looks. Remember that all along, the great temptation is realism. That is, the great temptation is to want some fact of the matter, some object out there to make my life true. Never going to happen. But to say realism is false, I'm saying, is equally now to say that in some constitutive sense, right, we are constituted by an absence of the object, an originary loss that we have to acknowledge. That is, whatever it is we might have wanted by believing that there was an object that could ground us in our relationship to the world, that original hope that's been there from sense certainty on, right? What does it mean to say that that desire is defeated? Well, along the way here, we've been saying, it means everything is internal to self-consciousness. Isn't that Jim Dandy? I mean, there's been... What I mean is, we've bought this kind of idealist line as if it's cost-free. As if everything we wanted by having the real object, we could get
by going idealist, by thinking that everything is internal to the object, as if no loss was involved in that fact. Right? As if, which is sometimes how I feel about what Wittgenstein does. I sometimes think he thinks we just get it all back. Right? And the suggestion that Hegel is making here is that there is this constitutive loss. There is this melancholia driving us over this lost object that we want to make good in our freedom. So we have, as it were, two impossible absolutes crunching against one another here. Our notion that we are subjects, which means free and self-determining, all the notions of subjectivity that go along with the notion of faith and pure insight on the one hand, and on the other hand, right, our sense that there is an object out there which, if we could be in possession of it, would ground us in our relationship to the world. But it's not as if we are easily going to get it all back. And right now, this is the moment. The moment here is a moment in which this problem of dependence has taken the form in which we do not, in that are requiring the moment of subjectivity, subjectivity is in these moods, in the Enlightenment, which means from the moment of Descartes to, for Hegel, the moment of German Romanticism. These moods is a continual experience because of this belief in self-grounding. That's the illusory belief. We can purely ground ourselves. Right? And in that mood of the attempt at self-grounding, there is a melancholic desire for the lost object. That it's the experience of loss that's driving these ever increasingly ever hyperbolic, ever pumped up desires to be purely self-grounding. So every time we fail to ground ourselves, we push the world further away. So what I'm saying is here, the Enlightenment has a disavowed grief for the lost object. And it's the disavowal of the grief that is ultimately going to run through and be the cause of the revolution. So one of the things that I'm going to try to be arguing over the next 4 or 5 weeks, 7 weeks we have left, is that this is a book which I said to you when we were reading Antigone about figuring out how to mourn. And if it's figuring out how to mourn, that is, how to lose the object in an appropriate way, which is to how to lose realism in an appropriate way, that's the claim, then if we're not yet mourning, then we're in melancholic despair. Right? We are, and therefore, in each active triumphal attempt to ground ourselves, we are simply disavowing the grief that's driving the project. How? All the Hamlet's about. How am I reading Hamlet? It's another course. No. Hamlet is the and by the way, Hamlet never gets there, right? Hamlet is cannot get over the loss of
I'm king of infinite space where now that I have bad dreams. It's the idea.
So, with this, then, so utility ends up as a vandalism which appropriates, manipulates, and consumes the last shred of objectivity, including the intersubjective world. And it reduces the intersubjective world to a collective survival mechanism regulated by a pleasure principle committed to a notion of reciprocal serviceability. Now, we know how this argument's going to go. That is, we know a bit about the arguments concerning utilitarianism. Utility, and I'll just say a few words about utilitarianism, and then we'll have a break, because it just... Hegel brings us to absolute freedom by thinking about utilitarianism. And the move is actually very, very simple. Indeed, it's very common. Utility, he begins by suggesting, cannot be a mere way of understanding the world, but must become a principle, an ideal. All things are to be judged according to their utility. And that raises all the standard problems of utilitarian moral theory, namely, how do we compare and contrast different desires? Which ones ought we to act on? Do we judge our desires by their qualitative character or by sheer quantity? What is the greatest happiness for the greatest number? We can go on and on, but we need not go on and on, because the question Hegel says is, wait a minute. Who's doing this judging? Who is doing the utilitarian reflective act? What kind of self is it that could attempt to become a utilitarian calculator? Well, a necessary condition for the possibility of being a utilitarian calculator is that the self must be detached from its given natural ends, and it must be free to order them in a particular way. So utility presupposes freedom, and it presupposes not just any old freedom, but free self-determination. Utility is a version of free self-determination. So the groundlessness of the nihilistic despair of Rameau's nephew becomes now as freedom of choice. We are now beginning to talk about the self as shorn of all determinacy. So we're now beginning to talk about, let's call it, sublime freedom. Freedom that always determines and is never determined. Natural desires and inclinations drop away as constitutive of who we are. So, if there's to be a system of goodness, it is going to be a system that is dependent for its satisfaction on our willing it. So, willing is the right or the correct kind of work of self-determination. And not just any old willing, my willing must be compatible with all others similarly willing. Hence, social order is both an experience of what I will and what we will. A fusing, an ideal fusing of the personal and impersonal standpoints. What we get now is a joining of individual and collective self-grounding. And what we get through self, will. Okay, let's stop there for a moment. Have a little break. I probably said too much already anyway. See if we can actually say something about the French Revolution.